Hi there, this is Catherine. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Digital Marketing Victories podcast. Before we get into this month's episode, I just want to share with you the ways that you can support the podcast if you're finding the episodes helpful. You can send me a donation at buymeacoffee.com/DMVpodcast. Any and all level of donation would be very much appreciated. Help me offset the cost of producing the podcast. I'd also encourage you to subscribe to our newsletter so that you don't miss a future episode or any other news about the podcast. And to do that, you go to wostrategies.com/newsletter. Okay, on with our episode.
Welcome to the Digital Marketing Victories podcast, a podcast about the realities of digital marketing. Listen in each month to learn about the tactics and strategies, soft skills, and technical requirements that go into digital marketing success. I'm Catherine Watsier-Ong, owner of WO Strategies LLC, an organic traffic consultancy.
And I'm Jim Keeney, owner of Federal Web Consulting and founder of DAP, the platform for the engagement economy. Welcome. Let's get into it and celebrate our victories.
Today, we're talking with Brendan Kumarasamy, the founder of MasterTalk, and he's going to talk about why he thinks every digital marketer should work on their own brand, and that includes having a YouTube channel. He also digs into tips for coaching your team or speaking at conferences, as well as informal meetings in our new age of social distancing where everybody's on video chats like Zoom. He digs into how you can ensure that your message is heard even on a medium that's that distracting. And I also got him to dig into a few tips for introverts who want to work on their soft skills. So because he manages his own YouTube channel, he also talks a bit about how he got to know his own customers for his YouTube channel and his business so that he can more effectively create and grow his YouTube channel and how he goes about managing that video creation process. I think you're going to learn quite a bit from today's episode with Brendan Kumarasamy. Brendan, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background, and how did you end up becoming a YouTube creator and being involved in public speaking coaching?
Yeah, of course. So my name is Brendan. I'm the founder of MasterTalk, which is a YouTube channel I started to help the world master the art of communication and public speaking. And how I got started YouTube, when I was in university, I used to do these things called case competitions. Think of it like professional sports, but for nerds. So while other guys my age were playing football or soccer or something else I didn't really understand, I applied the same competitive spirit to presentations. So for 3 years, I presented hundreds of times and coached dozens of students on their communication skills. When I got a job in corporate America after I graduated, kind of just asked myself a simple question. How do I make a difference in the world? And that's when I realized that the communication information available on YouTube as a platform was really bad. You know, you hear advice like, oh, Jim, you should be yourself and get up on stage. Like, what are you supposed to do with this advice? So I started making videos in my mother's basement. One thing led to another and the rest was history.
That's awesome. And particularly this podcast is focused on digital marketers. So how do you think public speaking could help digital marketers?
So the way I think about it is all of us are becoming media companies. What I mean by that is each individual has their own personal brand. And the way that they elevate that personal brand is going to help to sell their products and services, especially in a digital marketing space where you have different social medias and that's where all the attention is today. But the other part of that is thinking about this idea that the customer has a lot more information than they used to have. So 30 years ago, they didn't really have that much choice as much as they do now. Now with the click of a button, they know exactly what the product and service is. They know exactly what other people think about it is, and they can make decisions based on that. So when they look you up, when they look up your service, your product, and who you are, you want to make sure that you have content that showcases who you are really well. And using Portland as an example, so you guys are based there. Nike does a great job with this. You know who they are the second you think about their logo, and that's what helps them. Branding clearly goes a long way. And I believe that also applies to personal brands and products and services across all industries.
Do you also think a piece of that is in that digital landscape, it's harder to feel a personal connection to things? And so storytelling and audio, video really breaks through that barrier.
Absolutely. I think what's great about this era, Jim, is the game has gotten a lot more fairer in the sense that if your content is really good and the way that you communicate that content, storytell that content is very effective, it's still easy. It's much easier today than it used to be to get to that exact niche audience that needs you the most. And I'm a great example of this. I started MasterTalk when I was 22 and I started coaching C-level executives when I was 23. And the reason is just because I have the results, right? So it doesn't really matter who I am, as long as the market and the content that I create behind those services matches what the expectation of what the client is needing, it's fine. And that analogy applies for all industries. So I think it's a very fascinating time to be alive.
So that's an interesting, when you went to C-level, when you converted and took your business to the next level, what changes did you have to do? Or was it pretty much the same thing?
So there's two parts to that. It's a great question. One part was the digital marketing side, what changed. And the other part of that is just the pure business side. So it's on the digital marketing side. I think what really helped my cause, and this is something I recommend anybody who has a consulting business or a personal service, depending on what they're trying to achieve with it, is having an established YouTube channel really goes a long way. Even if you don't have a lot of people viewing your YouTube channel, you don't need a million subscribers. Since YouTube is one of the top search engines in the world besides Google and Amazon, it's a lot easier for people to find who you are at the click of a button. And since YouTube, you don't need an account to actually watch videos like every other social, I believe. What's great is you could just link a video and that's it. Like you have instant credibility. And that's how I've had much success in booking shows as well. It's you barely pitch, you just send the video and they go, wow, this person is either not a fit for the show or really a fit for it. So that's, I think, the beauty. And on the business side, to make a long story short, I had relationships. So my business partner is double my age and is a leadership coach. So I primarily use his client list. So that combined with the YouTube brand that I've been able to create has been beneficial for me in the last year.
So it sounds like it really came down to the perceived maturity gap was the only, other than building the YouTube channel, which of course, you know, that is a skill set and a work in and of itself. And that gives you the credibility. But the next, in terms of material changes to your business, it was bringing in those references that helped with authentication and perceived maturity gap, right?
Absolutely. And another tip I can give people who, you know, because I got a bit lucky with the relationship, but I would say that what I did before that, and it still worked pretty well, is a concept that I learned from one of my mentors called show, don't tell. Don't tell people you're a speech coach. Don't tell people you're a digital marketer. Get them the results. So one thing I used to do as an example is, let's say there's a C-suite executive I really wanted to work with. I'm very picky these days, but when I started, I just wanted to get that client base. So what I would send them an email, I wouldn't say, hey, I'm a speech coach. Why would they take me seriously? They're really busy people. What I did instead is I sent them a PDF and a voice recording of one of the keynotes that I watched on the YouTube and outlined the 57 mistakes that no other speech coach caught. And I just said, let me know what you think of it. They always reply with how much do you charge? It's always the same thing, right? So that's the key, right? Show, don't tell people you're a speech coach. Show them. Same thing with Master Talk. My YouTube channel isn't an ad for my services. I didn't even start the YouTube channel to build a practice. I want to be an executive at a company, like at an IBM or at a McKinsey. Right. That was my goal. Right. That's why I did these competitions. But because I focused on the content, the value, and that's what I still do today, despite how successful the business has become, is really just saying, how can I add more value to people through my content? And that's what's brought the success.
That's very interesting because I've been spending quite a bit of time this year speaking about voice search and hearing other people on panels talk about how with folks looking for stuff via voice, oftentimes the response coming back is coming from a brand and how much brands need to really think about their brand voice, like literally what their brand voice sounds. So there's in the digital marketing space, there's this increased fervor around figuring it out, both between the brand stuff being responded back and you needing to know what the brand sounds like and the fact that video is being shown more in Google search, 95% of the time it's YouTube. So there's this increased pressure on the digital marketing space to figure this out and to actually have a sound for your brand. Anyway, I think it's very interesting as you're talking about how digital marketers can think about public speaking and storytelling. I think it's very timely. So I'm curious about when you coach people, do you take a different approach depending on the output? So if they want to be on a podcast versus a Zoom presentation versus YouTube, do you provide different tips to them?
Definitely different tips for different scenarios. But the advice and the framework that I use is the same, and I'll explain why. Communication at the end of the day can be simplified in one sentence. As you master one, you become a master of all. What does that mean? if you get better at one of the verticals of communication, you get better incrementally over the others. So what does that mean? If you think about conversations, the better you get at conversations, the better you get at presentations. The better you get at presentations, the better you get at negotiation. And it all fills its own cup eventually until it becomes a multiplier effect. That's how I've always viewed communication. So the way that I think about my programs and my curriculum, I'm always happy to share that, is I always focus on one vertical first, and I have them master it, even if that person isn't looking to master the vertical, just to boost them. So I'll give an example. Presentations is by far the easiest vertical to work on, because you can see the results A to B really fast. And most people aren't really good at presentations because of how the education system taught them to present. Because most people present like this. Like, yeah, hi, everyone. It's so great to be here, Catherine. Whereas, let's say when I'm coaching or forcing them to get really good, they would sound like this. Good afternoon to the board of directors of Digital Marketing Solutions. My name is Brendan. I'm very excited to give you this person. Notice how it's very professional now. And we can get that in 2 weeks. So once you get that, what happens is then they get their confidence as a speaker increases, and then they feel they can master anything. And so that's where you want to get them. So the key is master one vertical. I usually recommend presentation skills first. And then the next ones should be prioritized in the order that you selfishly want.
Gotcha. Yeah. I do want to not let something go that you said 2 seconds ago. You said you'd become very picky about who you work with. What is that? I'm curious as to what you use to judge who would be a good customer.
Oh, that's interesting. Lots of cool questions. I'm having fun with this. It's great. So the way that everyone's going to have their own opinions, and it really depends on what your ideal business wants to look like.
I want your personal answer. I don't care about it, because that's going to give a more insight into how you evolved your thinking to get to that point. And I think that then they can come back and think about it for themselves.
Sure. Happy to talk about that, Jim. Yeah. So when I started, I had a very simplistic model. Get 40 clients one-on-one and scale from there. And boy, did I hate my life. Because of that, I started taking on clients that I didn't really like just because they would pay me. This is when I got started. This was very early, probably a year and a half ago. And I wasn't happy. I'd wake up on a Saturday. Instead of having 10 interviews, which is a lot more fun, I would have 10 one-on-one clients and let's say 3 of them I didn't really like too much. Because they just weren't implementing the advice and they weren't really great. But anyways, the point I'm driving is I had a reflection over what I wanted the business to look like in 10 years. And for me, it's a media company. I want to be the next Dale Carnegie. I don't want to spend 40 hours a week coaching people. So instead, what I did is I transitioned to a group model, which is right after this call, actually. I have 4 hours of coaching after this. But the point is, I have a kids program, coach my executives as kids. Yeah. So not really for money. That's really just to understand their psychology so I can make better videos for them on YouTube. Because the videos are essentially for the people who can't afford me, not the people who can. And then I call it the anti-customer. And then the other side of that is the executives who are the people. And I only work with people that are handpicked by somebody else because I don't want to go through filtering process. So it really depends what you want to build. But for me, since my focus is really 95% YouTube, I really focus my time on doing as many interviews as possible. And then I coach I coach 5 hours a week now.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense.
What have you learned along the way around running a YouTube channel and making it successful? Are there any other tips that you can share with their audience that might be struggling with their own YouTube channel?
Oh yeah, 100%. Here's the thing that most people miss. The one piece of advice, and that advice is that if you want 1,000 followers, have 1,000 conversations. Wow. I just think a lot of people are lost in this idea of, I have 10,000 followers. How do I get to 20,000? Or Brendan, I have 500 subscribers. Do you know how I got my first 1,000 subscribers, YouTube? I messaged 1,500 people individually and asked them to subscribe. Mm-hmm. Some of them I would send voice messages. I said, hey, I'm starting this YouTube channel. I know it sucks. I'm in my mother's basement. Could you please subscribe? I got to 1,000 subscribers in 60 days. Wow. And then after that, even today, still one-on-one DM. Anyone who DMs me on Instagram, I respond with a voice message. Even today.
Yeah.
I don't need to respond to anybody. I have a pretty thriving business. I don't care if they're – I remember, just to give you a crazy idea, just to show you how obsessive I am with my audience, in the same way Gary is, and he takes that on a whole other level. But we need to start understanding why people of his level, and that's true with any of those influencers, why do they still have one-on-one conversations with the general public? And the reason is because it's not worth it for them financially. I can tell you right now. And the reason is because to stay sharp, to always understand what their clients need, what their audience needs, so they can always constantly adapt the content to them. And the same thing with me. 3 weeks ago, somebody messaged me from this Success Speak Society. And they said, hey, we're a club. We'd love for you to come speak. So I just come for free. I was like, pro bono. And I realized when I got on the call that they were all high schoolers.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't expect that. I said, those are all high schoolers. So that's the key. It's all about adding value wherever you can and building a small fan base of super fans. That's how I've been able to grow Master Talk to the height that it is today. And I still plan on doing that. Just to give you another idea, I've probably done 350 interviews this year. I'm pretty nuts. So that's the key that I want to drive for people is it's the one-on-one conversations with the people who need you the most that scales your business and your impact and ideas, not the other way around.
It's fascinating because that's generally how I create content for my business is that a client needed it. And so I figure other people do too. And that's how stellarly focused it is.
Right. And just to give more YouTube advice, the other part of the advice I would give is to batch content years in advance. So the key to YouTube, in my opinion, is what's fascinating about the platform is a lot of the videos are evergreen. And so what this means for those who don't know who are listening is it means that even 3 years later, people can still watch your content today. That's not true with most social media platforms at all, actually. So what I recommend always is most people lose on YouTube. Most people. Obviously, you could debate, oh, but how do you mix current news with, I got you. But I think the main reason most people lose on YouTube is because they miss weeks. They're not consistent with their posting. Just to give you an idea of the behind the scenes, I have a full production team now and of two people who like create everything for me. And I write my content out 3 years in advance.
Wow.
So right now, like now during the Christmas break, I'm about to finish 2023. And then my goal for next year, because we're still in COVID, so I'm not flying as much as I used to, is to write my next 10 years of content so that I can only focus on promotion. I call it 99-1.
99-1? What does that mean?
Spend 1% of your time creating content, spend another 99% promoting.
Promoting. Yeah, the ratio. Yeah, and at the heart of it is that emotional resonance. So people are looking for something to connect to, and you've got that personal voice. But in addition to that, having those having those conversations with the people that you eventually want to grow your business into gives you the language that they use to describe the things that you're dealing with. And this is something I run into all the time is I try to help people understand, you know what you're trying to sell, because you're obsessed about it. You love your product, but that's not what your customer is asking at all. You need to get your head into the head of your customer. And the best way to do that is exactly what you said, which is talk to as many people as you possibly can, because there's subtle nuances to the way they talk about what they're interested in. And then when you use that same language back at them, that has a much more significant impact on them.
Yeah. And I'll give you the best example. That's a great comment, Jim. Is I'll tell you how that helped me with my business. There's nobody in the industry, in mine anyways, who's had more conversation with six-year-olds about public speaking. And the reason that's so effective, that's actually serious. I know it's funny, but there's
I'm laughing because that's a good thing.
exactly. Yeah, I know. We're all on the same page. And the reason that's so important is when I was at these pro bono workshops, and I would just talk to these 9-year-olds, these 6-year-olds, and I would ask them, what do you think about public speaking? They'd always go, I don't really like it. That gave me the best insight in the world. Nobody was creating content around how to use positive language in a way to communicate in an entertaining way, communication in public speaking that is fun and non-threatening.
Right.
So everything in my videos, the persona I use on YouTube is very well thought of. It's be this happy, perky guy so that the 5-year-old and the 50-year-old take me seriously. Because the 50-year-old will look at my videos and go, wow, this is really professional. He's got a suit shop and everything. But the 5-year-old will go, I actually understand what he's saying in every video. Because I use those videos for my kids' curriculum too. So if the kids don't understand it, then it's useless pretty much. But because I have that insight that nobody else in my industry is taking a look at, I can build a media company around public speaking and help millions of people rather than just the clients that I coach, which is the bigger goal.
Well, and I think one of the important things trend-wise is demographically, the baby boomers are finally letting go. So the next generation, companies are going to be asking constantly and pleading, what do we do about the younger generation? What do we do about the younger generation? And you've positioned yourself for that transition. And it's going to happen over the next 5 years. I actually think that COVID-19 is going to be the pivot point, where people start going, the world has changed. We're no longer subservient to the dollars coming from the baby boomer generation. And you touched on something that I wanted to ask, and you get this, I'm sure you get this question every time. How do you deal with people's fear and anxiety of public speaking? And you've answered it, but I want you to dive into it a little bit.
Absolutely. So the trick to fear is simple. The fear will always be there, all the time. But the way we need to think about it is it's like a boxing match. Let's say your fear is on one side of the ring and your message is on the other. The fear is always going to be in the ring, but you need to make sure that your message gets the knockout punch. What does that mean? And I'll use Brené Brown as an example. So for those who don't know, Brené Brown is an expert in vulnerability, one of the top speakers on the planet, and she hates public speaking. She's even upfront about it in the first TED Talk she ever gave. She's like, I don't really like public speaking. I'm a PhD in social work. I don't see why I do it. So what we need to ask ourselves is, why did she do it? You know, she didn't need to.
Right.
And the reason she did is because she had to make a choice. And the choice was, do I leave all of the knowledge that I've accumulated in books and research papers where a single mother with 7 children would never have the time to look at? Or do I take 30 minutes out of my life, summarize it in a very simple way so that it could maybe reach somebody like her? She made her choice. I made my choice. 22-year-old starting a YouTube channel on executive communication tips to help 15-year-olds and everyone else who can't afford me. Now you need to make yours. So the question I always ask myself is, who suffers from my inability to take action? And if you always ask yourself that question all the time, or questions like, how would the world change if you're an exceptional communicator? It's a lot easier for you to create an incentive around communication and dive for the finish line.
Yeah, it's interesting. Years ago, I founded and ran an improvisational theater company.
I love improv.
Oh, improv.
We both have a theater background, actually.
Oh, that's awesome. I have a whole video on theater.
And I was a debate geek, so there you go.
That's awesome.
So I always took it from the perspective of techniques rather than mental framework. And so there are simple things like one of the most uncomfortable things about public speaking, what have you, is the fact that we are physical entities. And there is nothing more uncomfortable than standing on stage because you don't have props. You don't have anything that you're actually physically doing. You're just theoretically up there talking. And so what I do is I literally tell them, go find props. Go figure out things that you can, even in this medium where you'll notice that I'm using my hands a lot. Okay. That is a physical manifestation of my thoughts that helps keep me on track. So I always took it from that perspective rather than the perspective that you described. And I think that that's a really good way to help people understand that it's just a choice that they're making. And if they're passive about it, then they get the results that they expect, right?
Absolutely.
I think it's fascinating, though, pivoting back to presentations, which is where you start people at. So digital marketers often have to sell through their ideas, which is what this podcast is about. Oftentimes that's via presentations, and now it's via Zoom. And I know in my previous life, I spent a lot of time, I was in a big agency, spent a lot of time trying to figure out the brains of the other people I needed to sell through to. So really trying to figure out, who is the audience? How would they resonate with this message? We would spend hours figuring that out and then tweaking the presentation to be successful for that. So I'm just kind of curious, what tips do you have on that end, where it's a corporate presentation, you've got news where you're definitely trying to pivot everybody's brain about something, and unfortunately it's via Zoom. So what are the tips that you provide there? Because I think that's where a lot of our digital marketing friends are today.
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing we need to keep in mind is the difference between online and offline presentations is that it's very difficult for you to gauge your audience's reaction.
Yeah.
So if I'm in person in New York giving a workshop to a group of folks in a marketing agency, I can see them. So if I say a joke and it's funny, I can see them laugh. But the opposite is also true. If my joke isn't funny and they don't laugh and go, why is this guy saying jokes? I also know to adapt my presentation to be less funny. But either way, I can tell when you're in a Zoom call with no cameras on, you can't really see how people are reacting. So the same joke that you said earlier, you need to assume it's funny. And that's where the added challenge is online. Even in a podcast like this with only three people on the call, I don't really know how both of you are reacting because you're both on tiny screens and I'm not looking at you two, which is the second tip. I'm only looking at the camera lens. That's why you need to have a picture of somebody that you love or a favorite food and put it next to the camera lens so that you're always looking at it. So it seems that you're looking at the person directly, even if you're not really. And then the third thing is always assume good intentions from your audience. You can do that from two things. One is you can get on a call with them before the actual meeting. That could be one person or a keynote you have to give just to understand who they are, back to your point, Catherine, which I completely agree with. And the other side of that is this idea of the other part of that is now that we understand who the audience is, now that we've gone on a call with them, the other side is to assume good intentions from them. So I'll give you an example of my podcasting journey. You know what a podcast essentially is, for those who don't know, is you get on a call with strangers who have done an insane amount of research on you, and you answer very uncomfortable questions. For those who are, these are actually not uncomfortable, but in most cases, that's what a podcast is. So when I started doing podcasts, it was a bizarre experience. You would enter on calls, you wouldn't know the people on the other side, and you're just saying, yeah, so, you wouldn't know how to answer the questions either when I started. People go, Brendan, where does the fear of public speaking come from? I go, my basement? I don't know.
The dark corner of your basement.
Right. But over time, as you do more of these, and this is true with presentations or any other communication meeting, you have conversations with them after the show. You realize that everyone's just trying to add value to their local communities, and you just start to assume that you've known them for a long time. So it transitions very quickly to, who's Catherine? Who's Jim? Look at Jim and Catherine. They're adding so much value to their communities in digital marketing. They've already been to Montreal. This is going to be an easy conversation. It's as if I already knew them. But that's a mindset shift that isn't overnight. It's more a belief system that eventually becomes true as you do more and more presentations.
What are the uncomfortable questions we should be asking you since you brought it up? Because you said we weren't asking uncomfortable questions.
Oh, yeah. No, I've gotten questions around the block and questions that come from me, frankly. My favorite question is, and it's not really as anything to do with public speaking, it's what are you pretending not to know?
Oh, that's a good one.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
How do you answer that to move on?
No, I don't dodge, actually. It really depends on the format. Like, for example, and that's a digital marketing trick. When you do a lot of shows and you're promoting your personal brand, there's different versions of you that you bring up depending on what the host prefers. Going back to what you're saying, Kath, it's whatever the audience wants, right? So I'm always adapting. Sometimes when I'm on shows, I'm talking about my personal story, my dysfunctional family. Other times I'm talking about public speaking. Other times I'm inspiring younger generation to take action. And this time it's a lot more professional, where I'm really diving into tactics and the behind the scenes with how I'm running the show. But it really depends on what the audience wants. And what the audience wants, the host generally knows. At least I hope. I usually let them guide the conversation.
Talking about what the audience wants. So a bit of this podcast is focused on soft skills. Because again, it's all about the hard part of digital marketing is that something has changed. Maybe the traffic has tanked. You have to convince a whole bunch of people to pivot or add more work to their plate. They don't report to you. So how are you going to persuade them to do X, Y, and Z? And a bit of that is the soft skills. And I noticed on your YouTube channel, you've got a bunch of videos about soft skills. And I was wondering if you had any particular tips that you'd like to share with our listeners about how they can improve their soft skills.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got an easy trick and an advanced one. So let's go with the easy one first, because most people don't implement this. When we think about relationship building, for most people in the business world, it sounds very daunting. They go, oh man, I got to go to this cocktail. I hope everyone likes me. I got to give everyone my business card. And it's just not fun. It's transactional. It's not interesting. And it's not fulfilling. So it's not a great space for you to work on your soft skills. My advice is very different. The way I think about life is you're only going to meet a handful of people in the world. So let's say, if we use numbers, you meet one new person every couple of days. So every year, that's give or take 100 people. So if you live for 50 more years, and I'm sure both of you live much longer than that, but let's assume that as a number, you do 100 times 50, that's 5,000 people. So in a sea of billions of people, you only have the chance to interact with a few thousand. So the question to ask yourself is not how do I get everyone to like me when you're thinking about relationships and soft skills, but rather saying, who do I want those 5,000 people to be? What values do they have? What do they stand for? Who do they want to be? What are they trying to achieve? And what should they aspire to be? When you start to ask yourself these questions, you start to filter all of the people that you're actually meant to talk to. And it's in that space that it is the easiest to work on your soft skills. It's a lot more daunting when you're a networking cocktail trying to talk to somebody who doesn't even want to talk to you versus saying, I'm a pen collector. Let me fly out to a pen collecting conference when COVID's over and talk to other people like me. So if I make mistakes with ums and ahs or I don't look confident, no one really cares because we're all a part of the same niche community. So that's what I would say outside of work. So what I always say to my executives is, Brendan, how does this apply at work? There's some people you don't want to talk to that you have to talk to, you have to interact with. How do you deal with that? My advice is always the same. You will never get better at communication in the boardroom. I'm very firm on that because you're always in a stressful situation. It's not a safe space for you to learn. And you're not really incentivized besides getting promoted at work to interact with people you don't like to interact with. Not the best place to skyrocket your skills. That's why for me, it's always take it outside of the boardroom. Go focus on your passions, interact with people you would otherwise wanted to interact with, and use those skills and bring them back to people that you don't like to talk to. That's always my advice.
Springing off of that, it's very much like customer discovery as well. So if you're running a company and you want to prep your skills for interacting with the boardroom, why aren't you talking to the people who work around you? And your customers, right? Because those are the two sets of knowledge that when you come into the boardroom are going to make the difference. So I recently went through a round of trying to raise money for a company. And the most powerful impact that you can have when talking to investors is, I talked to a customer and this is what the customer said. If everything that you're saying constantly is, well, I talked to a customer and the customer said this, and I talked to a different customer and this customer said this, and see how those two things relate to the product and the business that I'm building, you're always going to be successful. So for any company, there are basically two bodies of knowledge. What is your company doing? How is it processing? And what do your customers care about? You should be masters of both. The safe space is go talk to people. Exactly what you said.
So how do you transition that to our weird online space? So you're trying to find your tribe, or your, I don't know, 2021 resolution is that you're going to increase your soft skills. And most of us are not connecting in person. We're connecting online. So do you have any tips for that? If you've joined a meetup and it's a big Zoom call thing with a bunch of screens, is there any way that you can pivot and still work on your soft skills in this weird online world?
1,000%. So I'll give you the easiest trick in the book, and then we'll go a little bit more for those who are more adventurous. Easiest trick in the book is go to the people you actually like and just say, who's the most interesting person that you know that I should talk to? I have met some insane amount of people, including the head of global HR at Tesla, that I just talked to because he just knew somebody that I knew. And I just talked to, and it was the best one-on-one conversation I had this year. I was like, why is this person talking to me? But anyways, that's the point I want to drive. Is interesting people know other interesting people. Just message them and ask, right? I've met so many great, very intelligent people on shows that I've guested on, and I've maintained relationships with them. That's another way. The third way is I'm an advisor for a platform called High Right Now, which is essentially a networking solution that's free, and you can attend their free public events. You meet like 10 people in an hour. It's pretty awesome.
So, can you say that name again? Sorry.
High Right Now.
High Right
like
Now?
Like High Right Now.
All one word?
Yeah, three words.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. They have a free public event every Wednesday. Okay. So yeah, I've been using a lot of their I think I've met like 150 people off their platform. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So you always got to think, there's always creative ways to meet cool people. You just got to be a bit more creative, that's all.
Now, I'm getting a little bit of an inkling that perhaps you might be an extrovert, perhaps. And I'm kind of curious, what kind of tips do you have for people that are a little bit more on the introverted spectrum?
Absolutely.
But still need to persuade people and still need to present.
Absolutely. I've coached introverts who are way smarter and way more effective at communication than I am. And I think that there's a very big misconception that introverts are really bad at communication. So I think a good way of starting this conversation off is explaining why introverts are so good at what they do instead of just taking my word for it. So the first reason is they're much better listeners. As you probably tell, I'm a good guest on shows because I always yap all the time. Yap. I'm always talking because I'm an extra extrovert, as I like to call it. But because I do that, I don't listen enough to what my audience needs or wants. So I was a terrible listener the last few years. I got better recently, but it's something I've always struggled with. Introverts never have that issue. I've never met an introvert who's a bad listener. I don't, to my record, I've never met anyone. That's one. So they're able to tailor their message better to their audience. And whenever they speak, it's actually value add versus for me, it's maybe half the time because I'm always yapping. That's one. Two, after listening, the second thing that they do is they pause effectively in presentations. Pausing is something extroverts have a very difficult time grasping because when there's space in a conversation, they always want to fill it. So let's say we're all at a bar together. We're talking, chit-chatting, and and we all just pause. Somebody like me freaks out when they hear a pause. They go, oh, but did you see the game yesterday? Or did you? I always try and fill the space because it's just very socially awkward for somebody like me. Introverts don't have that problem either because they spend more time on average reading a book or spending time alone. So if there's a pause in a presentation, they're a lot more comfortable taking it versus somebody like me. It took a lot more time to master. I'm obviously comfortable with it now, but it took a while. Third thing is they're a lot less polarizing. So what does that mean? Let's take a Gary Vaynerchuk as an example here, since most people know him from digital marketing space. Gary is the kind of person that you either really like or you really don't. And that's the con of being an extroverted speaker. It's one of the disadvantages because you're either a super fan like I am, or you're somebody who goes, this person is, I hate this person. Mm-hmm. But if you compare him to a Seth Godin, nobody ever goes, I hate Seth Godin. I don't think there's a single person I know who's ever said that on record. It's just, he's an introverted speaker. He's less polarizing. He says things that are just true. And that's it. He doesn't yell at people. He's very respectful. So because of that, he has an advantage where most people in the room go, I really respect this guy. And Gary doesn't have that, unfortunately. But he has a lot more super fans. So it's all about pros and cons. But notice how I just broke down three key advantages that introverts have. So what's the message here? The message here is let's learn from each other. The person who's an incredible speaker is the person who says, this is who I am. I'm an extrovert in my case. Can I learn from the introvert? So what the introvert needs to do is two things. One, talk to other introverts to practice. And the other thing is learn from the extrovert. What are some of the things that Brendan is doing and other people like him that I should be implementing a bit more in my life? Not a lot more, just a bit. He doesn't need to yell like this on podcasts, but maybe he can increase his vocal projection a bit more. Maybe you can pause a bit less and say what you say, express what you say with more, a bit more conviction. And in the same way, me. Maybe I should pause a bit more. Maybe I should listen a bit more and spend more time understanding my audience. It's always a yin-yang that we need to master, and that's what the best in the game do.
And I think when you break it down into specific techniques that they can work on, that makes it much easier for them to work on it. Because this is very much akin to the fear of speaking conversation that we had earlier. You're constantly, if there's a big kind of concept and you say to somebody, go work on that concept, it's useless. It's worthless. And that's the heart of the whole cognitive-based therapy concept is, no, break it down into something pragmatic and practical that they can actually work on. In this case, if they find themselves when they're public speaking with long pauses that make everybody in the room uncomfortable, what they can do is prep what they're going to say in those pauses prior to conversations. One of the things that I found out about Winston Churchill, of all crazy people, is he always had the perfect phrase, right? He would come in and he would say these incredible catchphrases. He actually prepped those in advance. And he waited for those circumstances when the press or his colleagues were asking him questions where he could deliver those phrases. And coming up with those techniques that you can work on then gives the introvert or somebody who's uncomfortable with speaking the opportunity to practice, as you said, in those safe zones, right?
Absolutely. For me, the easiest trick that I recommend introverts do is just have conversations with people you actually want to talk to. I know this sounds overly simplistic, but it's the best way to practice. Just talk to have as many conversations as you can without making yourself too exhausted. And then over time, you'll eventually just love people in general and you'll be much better at social skills, even with the people you don't like. That's what happened with me.
So do you recommend that they do those conversations via phone or video chat? I'm just intrigued by Zoom fatigue personally, and how people might be listening better if it's a phone call versus video.
Yeah, I'm a very simplistic guy, as you probably tell from looking at my video, since I'm speaking to 5-year-olds and 50-year-olds. So the way I think about it, do whatever's comfortable for you. If you like the phone conversations, have the phone conversations. Like for me, I'm one of those guys who, after COVID's over, I'm going to fly back out to personal development conferences, sing Kumbaya, and hug all the strangers I don't know. That's just the kind of person I am. But doesn't mean it's still everyone who's listening, right? Not everyone likes a Tony Robbins seminar. So it's all about thinking about, where is your tribe located? Where can you find them, in an online space or an offline one? And how can you get to them as quickly as possible so that you can find the joy yourself and the benefits of what it means to connect with other human beings?
You talk a bit about storytelling on your channel and in your presentations. Can you expand on that? Because I think storytelling is fundamental to everything that you do and we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a very different opinion than most people in my space. I think most people who are listening should not focus on storytelling from a presentation context. And the reason I say that is because public speaking and core foundational public speaking skills is more important to focus on than storytelling, because storytelling is vague, it's super advanced, and no one really understands what a good story is. So if I did this once upon a time, there was a, and there's a, yeah, if I'm not good at public speaking, it's going to be hard for me to communicate a story. That's different, of course, in a marketing context. You don't need to be a speaker to be a Nike marketing campaigner. But I meant in the sense of when you have a personal brand, it's much more important for you to focus on your core foundational skills as a speaker, silences, ums and ahs, posture, mastery, confidence, all of that stuff first. And then once you get that a hang of, then you can focus on how to tell better stories. And I give you a quick teaser. What I usually recommend for storytelling is, the key to storytelling is understanding the following. When you understand your audience more than they understand themselves, if you can tell stories in a way that makes them feel that you understand them more than they understand themselves, you've mastered storytelling, hence why it's very complicated as a subject. And that's why we love Disney movies so much, not because of the random characters or the caricatures in those movies, but because we can relate to those stories in our personal lives.
That makes sense. And once again, we come right back to, do you know your customer?
I was about to say, why do some brands fail at storytelling? I think you just figured it out.
There's that interesting balance, though. For a company like Coca-Cola, the problem is they have too many different types of customers. But for most companies, most startups especially, their customers are pretty well defined. They just need to connect to them and understand them.
Yeah, and I can give you a great example of that. Before Airbnb came along, sleeping at a stranger's house and paying them for it existed. Like, it wasn't a new concept. VRBO and HomeAway existed long before Airbnb started. So what allowed Airbnb to scale that weird, bizarre practice to the general public? And in simplistic words, story and design. Right? They talked to their first 100 customers in New York City. They literally took photos of their apartments for them. They had lunch, dinners with all of them. They've met hosts from around the world, and they understood insights that most people didn't, the biggest one being design for trust. If you can design for trust at scale through software, you're going to be able to reach millions of people. Because if I trust the other side of the transaction, I'm going to be comfortable sleeping at their house. So that's the key, and that's what Airbnb understood by obsessing over their customer, and why they've had such a successful IPO last week. But that's the point I'm driving, is we all need to start doing that in our lives. Do things that don't scale, as Paul Graham puts it so well. And if you do that, I think you'll be very successful.
What's fascinating about that, as a software developer, Airbnb just released their visual design component library for React. They realized that, hey, we're doing this all online. And they took it down to the level of, we need to have a reliable set of components that can be used over and over again in a consistent fashion throughout all of our presentations. And they built an entire library around that. So yeah, consistency is one of the foundations of trust, right?
So I am curious. So as we talk about a lot on this podcast, and we just talked about, we focus on the audience quite a bit and obsess about it. Have you had a recent aha moment about your customers in particular, especially with all of those conversations? Is there anything that surprised you over the last year?
Yeah, a lot. Kids are a lot smarter than I gave them credit for. When I started the speaking program for the kids specifically, a lot of the videos I came up with in last year actually came from them. So one example is I was coaching this 12-year-old who started speaking like a world champion literally 3 weeks in. And even I was surprised, like, I didn't do this. So I asked him, I said, how did you get so good so quickly? And he said, oh, I used highlights. So what do you mean by that? He said, yeah, I took my script. And then I highlighted the words where I wanted to pause. I underlined the words where I wanted to use local vocal projection. And then I just did some, like, he just had a full legend. And I just went, whoa, that's really smart. Why didn't I think of that? I was like, how is this kid 12? This makes no sense. Another one is my most successful client, and I was proud to say, 6 years old. And she started the program. And I just asked her simple questions. What do you want to present? She's like, I don't know. I like school. And she was amazing. She had the professional mic and everything. I was like, damn, she's a superstar. So there's a lot more insights that you can get for kids that I think a lot of people are missing. I think Gary talks about that a lot. That's why he was very early on TikTok. He just listens to what kids, what the younger generation are saying. He just follows the customer. And if you stay like that, you'll always win.
And so I know you've shared a ton of resources actually on this podcast. So thank you. But is there an additional win or resource you want to share with our audience today?
Yeah, of course. The one book I'd recommend people check out is a book called Thirst by Scott Harrison. That's very heavily underlooked, very underestimated. Scott Harrison is the CEO of Charity Water. I think the marketing campaigns, the messaging, the branding, everything is spot on, 11 out of 10. And I think what we can learn as for-profit entities is how do we work with a very limited budget and bring a massive transformation or organizations from a messaging perspective. And I think Scott is the golden standard in that in the nonprofit sector. Because if he can do it, why can't you if you have more budget than he does? So I highly recommend people check out Thirst and check out Charity Water as an organization as well.
And that's the organization that you support, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And how can people learn more about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Very simple. All you have to do is go on YouTube and type Master Talk in one word and you'll find me.
That's great. I've really enjoyed the conversation today. This has been great, Brendan. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it was a little different from our typical conversations, but in a good way, I think. Because what we're trying to do with the podcast is get inside the mental and cultural process of digital marketing. Because what we're finding is it's still very much a nascent industry. People, it seems like it's been around, at least to me, it seems like it's been around forever. But in actuality, it's fairly new and young. And so we are dealing with a span of different people all the way from, hey, my CEO doesn't even get digital marketing, doesn't believe in it, all the way to I'm in the middle of digital marketing. I have no idea what I'm doing. And so in the middle of all that, though, the theme that keeps coming up is how do I communicate more effectively, both within the organization and with my customers. It just, every single guest that we've had has spoken around that.
Yeah. So this is perfect. This is the tactical skills piece that I think a lot of digital marketers could learn from for sure.
Thanks so much for listening.
To find out more about our podcast and what we are up to, go to digitalmarketingvictories.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please, if you like what you hear, spread the word. Rate us, comment, and share.
We're always looking for new topics, ideas, and guests. So if you have suggestions, please go to our website or email us at questions@digitalmarketingvictories.com.
And thanks for listening.